shoulder then. I'm younger than that now.
I'm Mark Middleton along with Bill Schaefer, and this is Growing Bolder, the show that's rebranding aging. What do you think about bookending today's shows with interviews with Melissa Etheridge and the Beach Boys' Mike Love? Oh, it's going to happen. Melissa Etheridge, the two-time Grammy and Academy Award-winning singer-songwriter, will join us in just a moment.
Radio worth listening to. And then later, we're going to talk to a founding member and lead singer of what many believe to be the most popular American rock band of all time, the Beach Boys. Mike Love is now 75 years old and offering, for the first time, his take on the Beach Boys and how he became one of the most despised figures in all of rock.
Plus, we've got a doctor who started an international healthy lifestyle revolution and a graphic design legend, all today on Growing Bolder.
Want to know where you stand on risk? Are you somebody who's willing to take a chance? You know, some people thrive on it, others run away from it. Not talking about anything foolish or uncalculated here, but coming up with a goal, determining a path, and then taking it. This is important, folks, because the byproduct of risk is growth. We're going to talk now about the value of risk.
Life is risk, Mr. Schaefer. And take, for example, somebody like Melissa Etheridge. She's a great songwriter, incredible singer, somebody who has all the tools for success. However, the ingredient that she's probably best known for and most respected for is her courage in taking risk and being honest and open. Along with her talent came respect. Life has thrown some pretty tough things at her, but she has stood tall in the face of many, many challenges. Her latest risk is her latest album, Memphis Rock and Soul. Let's talk about it now with the one and only Melissa Etheridge. Hey, Melissa, how are you?
Hello, I'm great. I love that we're talking about this.
You know, thank you so much for honoring us by giving us this time. You really are taking a risk here. I mean, I think we all know your talent. It's not that big of a risk, but you did dip into a legendary Stax Records catalog, drawing from the very roots of rock and roll. What made you step up to that risk?
Well, because actually, if you, have been following along, I live by the a great thing that someone once told me, which is do something that makes you a little uncomfortable every day. and you start living that, you start really getting out there and stepping up and looking inside and going, wow, this is what I love, this is what I would love to do, and then checking out your fears. Well, you know, let's take the Memphis project. It was, you know, what am I going to do next? Wow. Well, I'm a singer-songwriter, and I've been on this path. What if I jumped over here and I did a collection of music that is so beloved, that, you know, that is so historic, that is so the roots of the whole rock and roll modern music movement, and try to cover that? Yes, that would make me uncomfortable. Yes. let's see. And then I get to rise up and do my best and try and succeed in my own mind of, yes, this is the performance I would love to do, and let me go, you know, get in with the musicians that live down there. I went down to Memphis and played with these musicians who have played with these great artists for, you know, the last four decades, and just immerse myself. And if nothing else, if it was not a success, the journey, the absolute experience of doing this is enough to fill me, you know, and lead me on. And that's sort of where it came from.
And as the saying goes, Melissa, from risk comes reward. Only in this case, the reward, folks, is ours. Let's listen to a little bit of Melissa Etheridge from Memphis Rock and Soul.
When the day comes and you're down in a river of trouble and about to drown, hold on, I'm coming, hold on, I'm coming.
A little bit of Sam and Dave from, is that you wailing on that 12 string?
Totally.
Oh, man.
That's a, you've got a solo version of me. I'm trying to figure out what that's from.
This is you know, you are so pure, and it's so great to hear you stretch out and try different genres and say different things with your music. Where did you get this ability to make your instrument speak so many languages?
Wow. Thank you. That's quite a compliment. But I grew up in the Midwest, and I grew up in the 60s and 70s. I was surrounded by this amazing music, even though my parents were not musical. There was nothing out of the ordinary of any lower middle class family in the Midwest. My father was a high school teacher. My mother worked as a civil servant. And so they raised me with this, you know, you want to be better than what you have. You want to reach out. You can do anything. They didn't discourage me. I didn't have that in my life. And so that was probably the best ingredient. They said, you know, hey, good luck with whatever you want to do. Just be self-sustaining and be happy. And so I think the path has led me to keep walking this journey of truthfulness, which is super important. And that clears the way then to put all your energy into what you love. And I love doing this. I love it. Brings me much joy, and the more I see the joy it brings other people, then that's just, it's just like rocket fuel.
You know, I almost hate to make a bit of a turn here, Melissa, because your music, this album is so fabulous, but we mentioned your challenges, and sometimes I think that the highest value of celebrity is not necessarily to entertain, but maybe to inform and to educate, and you certainly have done that with the way you have reacted to your cancer diagnosis. Can you share with us what it was like? Can you recount the moment you heard the words, "You have cancer"?
Yeah, that was an incredible journey. And it was one that I was 43 years old. This was 12 years ago. I am 12 years cancer-free now. And it was one, at that moment, realizing, oh, it's everything stops now, everything. The road I've been on, the pace I was keeping, the thoughts I was thinking about myself, the food, the you know, sugar addiction, all the things that were causing this acidic behavior inside of me, all these things that were leading to what I believe was a cancerous situation, everything stopped. And I was able to then walk through this experience, which is, you know, pretty horrific, and too many of us are going through it, and certainly know people that are going through it. And walking through it, getting out on the other end and going, okay, this is about health now. So much about health is about happiness. And it's about understanding, taking care of yourself first, then looking out and taking care of others. There's so many ways to change your life, to change your habits and thoughts about yourself and about food.
You know, it's one thing to survive it, Melissa. What does it take to thrive in the face of cancer?
It takes letting go of your diagnosis and not letting it define you, in that you there's nothing wrong with you. It was cancer to me was a sign, was a warning, was a chance for me to absolutely change everything. And change is wonderful. Change can be amazing. And so that's where I walk from now. And it gives me great happiness and great hope every day to be thankful, gratitude, huge gratitude every single day, just to be a living, breathing part of this wonderful universe and world and this new day that we have today. It's just, I'm so grateful.
Speaking of gratitude, speaking of this new day that we finally have today, congratulations on your recent wedding. Being in your in your 50s, were you ever starting to worry that maybe marriage wasn't in the cards for you?
Yeah, not worry. I was not very good at it. So the you know, the relationships, the whole figuring out that whole part of my life, I'd not done very well. And I have really started working on myself, and so often this will happen, is it's not about somebody else coming in and making my life, you know, better or perfect. It's about me taking a hold of my life and the responsibility for me, for my own joy, and to fill up myself and fill up my self-confidence and self-esteem and self-image and self-worth and all these things. And boy, I tell you, the minute you start doing that, the minute you really look inside yourself and build that up and make you strong in that area, you become very attractive. And that's when you attract people who are also strong in themselves, who really have love to give because they are filled with love. And that's when I met my wife now, and that relationship started from such a better place than I've ever started any relationship. And this is what makes it work, and this is what makes it the marriage, the successful marriage, is it's built on two people who have a solid self-worth and foundation in themselves, and then they can love each other. So it's just a great relationship.
You know, one of the stereotypes, Melissa, that we try to break on this program is the one of age, that opportunities tend to disappear and your productive days are over once you hit a certain age. But look at you. You're a cancer survivor, a Grammy winner, mother of four kids. You're touring behind this great new record. Age has not been a problem for you.
No. Age is in your mind. Age is just a speedometer. We don't need to – it tells us nothing. Age is experience, and believe me, I would not trade in my 50s for any other time that I've lived. You get the payoff for all the hard work. You understand more. Wisdom is something that's learned. You can't be taught it. You know, you just have to learn it. And you know, here I am, and it's so much better. And boy, if you're looking at 50, don't even be afraid. It gets so much better and stronger. And this is when taking care of your body, your mental health, this is when it's not a chore, it's a pleasure to really to be in this time and to be the strongest and the best that you can be.
You know, you've had such an amazing life, so many fascinating experiences, lots of challenges, lots of triumphs. What do you hope we can learn from you? What's the moral of the Melissa Etheridge story?
Oh, I hope the moral is speaking your truth is the greatest reward. Because I can tell you, I can show you every single time in my life that the choice was in front of me of hiding and not being who I am or being who I am and speaking truthfully about it. The rewards are, you know, not only does your record sales go up, you know, you can look at that, but also just the personal rewards and the peace that comes from that. I would just urge people to be their genuine, truthful self, to find their truth inside and live that. That's the whole point. You're not here to live somebody else's life or someone else's version of what they think you should live, be it your parents or loved ones or anything. It's you. You are an individual. Live your life. Live your truth. That's what it's about.
Wow. You know what? As fascinating as a performer you are even more dynamic as a person. And that is so great to hear. You've dropped a lot of inspiration on us today. The name of this album is Memphis Rock and Soul. And folks, you hear where it comes from and you hear what's behind it. She is the fascinating, inspiring, and empowering Melissa Etheridge. Thanks so much, Melissa.
Coming up, the little-known story of how Bill and I helped transform the trucking industry. That's next on Growing Bolder. Growing Bolder and Humana are celebrating the opportunity of aging and smashing stereotypes with the new 65 Plus. We're sharing examples of people 65 and older who are pursuing their passions and leading happy, healthy, and active lives. You can inspire others by sharing your own photos and stories. Find more information at growingbolder.com/new65plus.
Half-right prejudice, leave before, rip down all hate ice cream.
Now, 5 years ago, Mark and I went to Arizona to cover the U.S. Masters National Swimming Championships. We shot a lot of stories there, including one on a guy who just happened to really capture our attention.
Yeah, we could see he was a good swimmer, but we had no idea he was a truck driver. After our story aired, his life changed, and then so did the entire U.S. trucking industry. Sapiwe Baleka has traveled to Gresham, Oregon to compete in the U.S. Masters National Swimming Championships. A multiple National Masters champion, Baleka has quickly become a big name in Masters swimming, but an even bigger name in the world of long-haul trucking. Long-haul trucking has the highest rate of obesity of any occupation, and truckers have a life expectancy 20 years below the national average. Which brings us back to Baleka, who in the early 90s became the first African-American to be named All-Ivy when he competed for Yale. After failing to qualify for the 1992 Olympics, he quit swimming and traveled the world for 15 years. In 2008, still searching for his future, he took a student driver course and became a long-haul truck driver.
When I started driving a truck, you know, I noticed I started to eat a lot of junk food and started to get heavy, and I made a commitment to myself that I wasn't going to end up a statistic. Most truck drivers are overweight, so I just started working out every day on the side of my truck, and I felt good, and then I kept it up.
He felt so good that he entered the 2011 U.S. Masters National Championships in Arizona. Growing Boulder just happened to be covering that meet. With his father rolling the video camera and his children watching him swim for the first time ever, Baleka came back from a nearly two-decade layoff to win two national championships. Encouraged by his results and seeing a major need, Baleka launched a website aimed at trucker fitness. At the same time, Growing Boulder's video on the truck-driving swimmer went viral. Suddenly, Baleka had the attention of an entire industry.
That story that Growing Boulder produced and aired brought a lot of attention. It gave me a platform to talk about how to help people who are sedentary or who are overweight or obese and haven't worked out in a long time. It gave me a platform to talk about it specifically in the trucking industry. And then I was able to reach other carriers and truck stops and industry associations because of that video. So it really has helped my business. It gave me some credibility. It allowed me to take my success in the pool and use it for something bigger than myself.
Baleka founded his own company, Fitness Trucking, and was named Driver Health and Fitness Coach at Prime Inc., a commercial trucking company with nearly 7,000 drivers. He's been dubbed the fitness guru of the trucking industry and featured in many national media reports.
My whole mission was to take the unhealthiest occupation and make it a model for one of the healthiest corporate wellness programs. And that's happening. It's spreading throughout the industry, and I'm going to keep working on that until the entire industry is an example of what can be done. And if truck drivers can do it, anybody can do it.
In the recent national championships, Baleka swam seven events and came away with seven gold medals and one national record.
Take your mark.
And I've been getting faster every year, and I'm approaching times that I did in college. And so I'm super motivated, you know, to do that, and excited that, wow, I can actually swim this fast still at 45 years of age.
It's been a long haul for Sapiwe Baleka. He never dreamed he would drive a truck and certainly never imagined that he would transform the trucking industry. But the moral of his story is a Growing Boulder lesson for us all.
It's what my father taught me. It's worth it to do your best. Whatever you do, do your best at it. You finish what you start, you go to the next thing, but you always give your best. And it's worth doing. You get the most out of life that way.
It took decades, but Sapiwe Baleka found his future when he climbed behind the wheel of a big rig and then remembered his past. In addition to everything Sapiwe has going on, Simon & Schuster now publishing his new book, and he's been named the spokesperson for a National Healthy Trucker Initiative.
He's such a great guy, yet another example of how many different ways there are to make a living doing something you love while helping others at the same time.
Up next, a design icon, a man considered the greatest American graphic designer of all time. This is Growing Boulder.
Stay connected to Growing Boulder for daily doses of hope, inspiration, and possibility. Find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram for our latest stories and motivational pictures. The following interview was recorded before the passing of our guest. Bill Schaefer and Mark Middleton here. You're listening to Growing Boulder. Our next guest is a graphic design legend considered really by just about everyone to be the foremost graphic designer of modern time.
Yeah, this guy is the real deal. In fact, he designed the iconic I Heart New York poster back in the 70s. But folks, that is just the tip of a very large creative iceberg. He designed the psychedelic Dylan album cover, all of the key art for the final season of Mad Men, and on and on and on. And at 87, he still goes into work at his Manhattan studio every morning. Let's welcome Milton Glaser. Hey, Milton, how are you?
Hi, considering everything, I'm great.
Well, thank you so much for taking a short break to chat with us. You have personally designed and illustrated more than 300 posters, including, as we mentioned, the I Heart New York poster back in the 70s when it was tough for anybody to love New York. Were you surprised by the extent to which that design resonated? And why do you think it was so successful? What makes a great poster?
Well, those are very complex questions, continually. Continually as a sequence of events. I designed that in 1977 and had no idea at all that it would remain alive up until today. In fact, I can't walk through the streets of the city without encountering it several times. So for one reason or another, it has embedded itself in people's memory system and gone around the world several times, for reasons that are totally inexplicable. Why people prefer certain things and why they have preferences about color or shapes or forms or messages in general is really generally incomprehensible. I know that one of the things about it was that it was not an attempt at persuasion as much as it was a reflection of the way people were feeling. What that represents was really an expression of everybody in this town who was really wanting to express their desire and their love of the city in a way that was obvious to all. There's something about expressing the reality of what you're experiencing that makes it important to you and intensifies it. It's like declaring your love for anyone. You also declare your love because you recognize the vulnerability of the city in this case and the realization of your own affection that you never thought about. And then, of course, it was like all things that originate in New York. It was picked up by other places, other countries, and it was so the world was waiting for a way to say, I love something. And as you know, it has been used for that all around the world. It's hard for me to believe that that didn't exist before, but apparently it didn't. Mm-hmm. Although the association with the generality of hearts and love existed, the use of it in this sort of very explicit way, I love something, had never really occurred. The other thing I try to explain is that it's a puzzle when you first look at it. I is a word, the heart is a symbol for an experience, and NY are the initials of a place. So the mind has to go through three steps, a little puzzle solving. It's an easy puzzle, ultimately, but the act of solving a puzzle embeds things in the mind in a way that simply reading something in its totality doesn't produce. So one clue to its durability is the fact that at first people have to exercise their brain in order to understand it. Everything else that follows, I have to admit, too complex for me to understand.
You know, Milton, one of your first posters, I believe, takes us all the way back to 1966, that Bob Dylan album cover that Mark had mentioned earlier in the program. How important was that to your career?
Well, that was very important to me at a time when Dylan was suddenly being recognized as the kind of cultural force that he was. And, of course, over the next last couple of weeks, we have been aware that with the awarding of the Nobel Prize, that this is an unprecedented occurrence for a songwriter. But even then, there was the sense that there was something different about this songwriter. And I was commissioned by Columbia to create this for the album itself. It was inserted in the album. And so immediately it was distributed to 6 million people who bought the album. So it got a kind of running start. And it became symbolic of a moment in the history of music in this country. And again, has lasted an awfully long time because Dylan has lasted an awfully long time.
And you received a big award back in 2009, the National Medal of the Arts from President Obama, the first graphic designer to actually receive that award. Do you like awards, Milton? You've gotten so many of them, or is it not about that for you?
Well, it's always nice. I'm sorry my mother wasn't alive to see me get the National Award from Obama for the arts. That would have pleased her mightily. But outside of it, after you get a certain amount, while you're appreciative, the one thing you don't want to do is turn up at the award ceremony. Because as you get really old, and I am, those events become overwhelmingly boring, even though your appreciation for the award itself remains constant. Turning up becomes an ordeal.
Milton, are you really 87? Because you sound on the phone here like you're about 37. How creative are you? More creative now than you have ever been before? Where does all of this that you've experienced, where does that put you right now?
You know, it's an interesting point of view of somebody is doing a book on the work, later work of artists like Picasso or Degas, where you see a transition between what has happened throughout their life if they live long enough. You change your vantage point. Certain things occur early, which is a display of virtuosity. What you want to show in the early days are how skilled you are and how dazzling that skill can be. So you really want to show off. And then increasingly, as you get older, if you're not stupid, you realize that showing off is not the point. And that what you want to do is work that transforms the viewer, work that basically provides an alternative way of seeing what is real. And even though you're not officially in the world of art, you are in a kind of world that is adjacent to art. I guess the recognition of Dylan as worthy of the Nobel Prize is an indication that even songwriting can become a device to improve culture. And I guess what happens later in life, what you want to do are things that move people and make them aware of what reality is. So the work itself physically changes in appearance. It becomes simpler, more powerful, and more effective in terms of how it communicates. It may even look less interesting, but it means you have to spend more time understanding it.
You know, I wish we had more time, Milton. I would love to talk more about your creative process, because obviously it is a very intellectual process in addition to something that's intuitive. But you have designed some of the world's most well-known logos and posters. You've redesigned many, many magazines. You co-founded New York Magazine. You've done so many things. And along the way, you've designed what appears to be a pretty satisfying and rewarding life. What is the moral of the Milton Glaser story? What have you learned about life in your 87 years in general that you can share with us today?
Well, if possible, never have a job. Yeah. Because if you have a job, someone ultimately will take it away from you. So this is something that I heard on the radio from John Cage 35 years ago, and it's quite true that not having a job permits you a range of activities, if you can survive, that's far more satisfying than going to work and doing something repetitiously day after day. The other thing I learned is that once you have mastered something, give it up. And then I learned as much from Picasso as anyone else. As soon as Picasso could do something well, he gave it up and moved elsewhere. So his life was a constant search for alternative views of the world. And as such, he stayed engaged throughout his whole life, stayed alive, stayed intellectually active, stayed in a state of thought. He kept thinking. He didn't sort of go to sleep repeating what he had already done 100 times. I think it's very easy as you age to simply enter into a phase of repetition of what you already know, what you've already done. And it's a sort of slow death until you disappear. But I think if you try to create a situation where you re-engage the world after you've learned how to do something, something else happens. You become aware of the fact that you're still alive.
Milton, we have asked that question to some of the greatest thought leaders alive today, and I got to tell you, that may be the best answer ever. Folks, he is Milton Glaser, the godfather of modern graphic design, proving that creativity is an ageless resource. Milton, thanks again for your time. Up next, one of the true good guys in the world of medicine, a renowned cardiologist who started an international healthy lifestyle revolution and isn't done yet. This is Growing Bolder. We've got news. Watch.growingbolder.com, the world's first streaming site for active adults, is now live. Growing Bolder TV shows, national specials, documentaries, and inspiring videos on ordinary people living extraordinary lives 24/7 on demand for free. Watch.growingbolder.com is now live.
Bill Schaefer and Mark Middleton here, and you're listening to Growing Bolder. Our next guest is one of America's top cardiologists, a doc who started what's growing into an international healthy lifestyle revolution by inviting his patients to go on walks with him.
Yeah, and as you folks know, one of our pet peeves are doctors who prescribe medication ahead of lifestyle modification, but this guy is very different. He founded Walk with a Doc, a unique nonprofit whose mission is to encourage healthy physical activity in people of all ages and to reverse the debilitating consequences of a sedentary lifestyle. Welcome a man who has been named a CNN hero, Dr. David Sabger. Hey, Doc, how are you?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for taking a pause from your busy day to help us spread the word about the good work you do. And let's start with the facts about heart disease, because it is the number one killer in the U.S. The good news, though, and I think probably the frustrating news for people like you, is that it's preventable, and most of us don't take the steps to do that.
We have such a great opportunity in front of us. 80% of cardiovascular disease is preventable, and as you guys know, if you stop and think about that just for a split second, that's pretty incredible. So every day we approach with this, you know, this incredible opportunity in front of us to really make a difference in people's lives. And as you know better than anyone, the medicine, in air quotes, tastes really good. If if going for a walk or a bike ride or a swim is a way to make yourself better, you're really, the medicine tastes great.
Well, if you didn't think that it would make a big difference, I'm sure you never would have started this Walk with the Doc program. You've been doing this for over 10 years now. What gave you the idea or put the thought in your mind, and how does it work?
Yeah, we started this back in 05, and it was years of frustration. I did my residency and fellowship at Ohio State University, and we had plenty of time to meet with patients instead of the typical 15 to 30 minutes that we have now. We had a full hour, and I would spend a lion's share of that time talking about how critical physical activity was after we addressed blood pressure, cholesterol, diabetes, etc. I really wanted to rip the weed out at its root, and this seemed the way to do it. We would have patients come in that were doing fantastic and experiencing a very high quality of life, and the common denominator with them was going for a walk or doing some type of physical activity, line dancing, what have you. And then, unfortunately, the much bigger line on the other side was suffering all the ill effects of a sedentary lifestyle. So it was really trying to move the latter group over to the first group, and I thought I was really good at it. I thought I was connecting. I felt a ton of empathy, and it was successfully being shared with the patient, and it turned out that I was horrible at it. I was while I was communicating it at the highest level I knew how, when these patients came back for 6 or 12 month follow up and were in Ohio, obviously Ohio State, but it had either been too hot or too cold. And I was looking forward at the next 30 to 35 years, thinking I did not want to play this charade. I had to do something different. So at frustration towards my inability to successfully communicate, one day I said, how about if my family and I were at the park? And it was magical. That first patient, I saw something different in their eyes. It seemed like something that they definitely had interest in, as opposed to going to sign up at a gym. And moving forward from there, I hate to sound this way, but every day has been a gift. Every day has been filled with hope and promise, and very, very fortunate.
So, folks, here's a physician, a doctor, who actually meets up at the park with his patients, and they walk together and they talk about whatever is on the patient's mind. It's kind of a commitment, a buy-in by the patients to get going. And as Dr. Sabgar mentioned, that was 2005. Today, you've got over 270 chapters, plans to grow to more than 5,000 worldwide. Is it hard to recruit doctors like you who are willing to give up some of their personal time?
Well, it's very kind of you, everything you said. Initially, it was very, very difficult, and now through the help of partners and awareness, just like our conversation today, we've got 850,000 docs in the U.S., and we have probably an equal amount of nurse practitioners and PAs that are taking wonderful care of patients every day. We're able to capture so many more now than we were in the past. So I'm very optimistic that we can capture enough to get 5,000 communities or more going.
Hey, Doc, we've got about 45 seconds left. If you'll indulge me, just two or three quick questions with some quick answers, some personal stuff. A, should I get a treadmill desk? Are those good?
Yes, I love them. Tried to have been sponsored by the company. They won't sponsor us, but I still love them. So,
right.
Yes, I, I think it's not necessarily for fitness, but more creativity. I'm a huge fan. We've had three now for a couple of years.
Number two, I occasionally like a glass of red wine. I get frustrated by, yes, it's good for you, no, it's not good for you, a little bit. Can I drink red wine every now and then?
Not only red wine, but any type of alcohol in moderation is very healthy. Women have to be careful as far as there's a modest increase in breast cancer, but cardio-wise, it's extremely protective.
Walking is not very good for you, is as good as running for you, is better than running for you. Where does walking fit in terms of the hierarchy of stuff that's good for you?
My belief, it's equivalent to running. If you're going to cover 3 miles, you'll get equal benefit. Whether you're running or walking, it'll just obviously take you longer if walking, but you'll get the same benefit and, of course, lower impact on the joints.
Folks, he is Dr. David Sabger, founder of Walk with a Doc, a free, unique, physician-led program that is saving lives worldwide. If you'd like to join a walk, start a walk, support a walk, or learn how walking can actually save your life, just check out walkwithadoc.org. Thanks, David. We really appreciate your time. Coming up, they are unquestionably one of the greatest rock bands of all time, and their backstory is one of the most titillating and bizarre. It was not all good vibrations for the Beach Boys. We'll get Mike Love's version of their story next on Growing Bolder.
Well, she got her daddy's car, and she cruised through the hamburger stand now. Seems she forgot all about...
Sign up for the Growing Bolder Insider Newsletter, delivered to your inbox every week. Be the first to see our latest interviews, stories, and tips for making each day count. Sign up today at growingbolder.com. Miss an episode of Growing Bolder Radio? Subscribe to our podcast and get it on your mobile device. Details at growingbolder.com/podcasts.
I'm picking up good vibrations. She's giving me the excitations. I'm picking up good vibrations.
The unmistakable sound of the Beach Boys. I'm Mark Middleton. You're listening to Growing Bolder. Hard to believe, but this is the 50th anniversary of Good Vibrations, considered one of the finest pop songs ever recorded. Composed and produced by Brian Wilson with lyrics by Mike Love. Rolling Stone ranked it number 6 on the list of the 500 greatest songs ever. And our next guest is a founding member and lead singer of arguably the most popular American rock and roll band of all time. 13 gold albums. His writing credits include, in addition to Good Vibrations, California Girls, I Get Around, Fun, 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 Surfing USA, and more. He's a member of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and he's got a candid, revealing memoir that has everybody talking. It's called Good Vibrations, My Life as a Beach Boy. Let's welcome Mike Love. Hey, Mike, how are you?
Thanks, Mark. I'm good.
I guess the question is, considering the history of the band, what took you so long to tell your story?
Well, in addition to procrastination being a trait that I've perfected to an art, there have been millions of words written about the Beach Boys, but never by me. So I finally decided that it's time that I got myself motivated, and partially my father died a couple of years back, and I figured my kids and my grandkids and friends and fans who would like to hear from me, it's about time I embarked on this journey and wrote this book. So I had some excellent help from Jim Hirsch, who's a New York Times best-selling author. He did all kinds of research. We spent all kinds of time together, and it took about a 3-year journey. But finally, last month, Good Vibrations, My Life as a Beach Boy, came out, and, the first week it was out, it came in on the New York Times bestseller list, which was awesome.
Man, congratulations to you. And despite your many contributions, you have been routinely marginalized and even written out of some other previous unauthorized books. You even admit that you've been a polarizing figure. In fact, you seem to embrace that by describing yourself as, quote, both a peacenik and a badass, a butterfly and a switchblade. Who are you? What are you now at age 75? Have you mellowed a bit, Mike?
Well, you know, I guess that the thing started when I was not credited for writing some of the songs you mentioned at the beginning of our talk. And so I was eliminated by my Uncle Murray, and my cousin Brian couldn't rectify it, and it took years to finally get credit for writing those songs with my cousin Brian. So, you know, and then there were lifestyle choices. My cousins, Brian, Dennis, and Carl, went down the road of some pretty serious drug experience, and I took another direction, which after learning Transcendental Meditation in December of 67 and becoming a teacher of TM and stuff, I went in a whole different direction. So there was a schism or a division in the group based on lifestyle choices. So there were people who thought that my being outspoken against drugs and stuff was uncool because they thought it was a very happening, cool thing to do LSD and other things as well. But in my cousin Brian's book just came out recently. He talks about cocaine being the reason, talked about it killing his brother Dennis. And so, you know, Dennis passed away in 1983. And so I've never been a big fan of all that. So there was definitely some, you know, contention there on that basis.
Folks, we're talking with Mike Love, one of the founding members of the Beach Boys. He's got a new memoir out called Good Vibrations. It is fascinating. And, Mike, you touched on a couple of these things. I mean, Good Vibrations is one of the great all-time songs, but the reality is, as you just noted, it really was not all good vibrations for the Beach Boys. A very talented, dysfunctional family. I mean, you write about Dennis, the drummer, your cousin, who, as you noted, died years ago, slept with your first wife, married one of your daughters, and then hired Susan Atkins, a Manson family murderer, as a babysitter for one of your kids. If reality TV had existed back in that day, you guys would have been all over everywhere.
Yeah, I'm sure we would have. Well, you know, he made some pretty bad lifestyle choices, and he did have a roommate named Charlie Manson along with the other girls. Now, I only met the guy once, but that was enough. But I detail that in my book, and he did, you know, they did have an affair, and that was a real source of you know, some animosity between the two of us. But also he made a call to me from Paris to get me to come back to Paris to learn to meditate, and Maharishi instructed us all in Transcendental Meditation, which I stuck with and the other guys didn't. So it was a mix, you know, that there were the good things that happened and then there were the not so great things.
And, of course, you mentioned Brian, who does have his second memoir out. And all Beach Boy fans, I think, probably, Mike, have seen Love and Mercy, the biopic about Brian. The film and other accounts have portrayed you as someone who fought his efforts to expand the band's sound, allegedly having you even saying, don't F with the formula. Is that true or not?
Well, I addressed that in the book, and it's quite untrue. I mean, I never said that. That was in regards to the doing of our Pet Sounds album, which was brilliant. He did some great tracks. I sang and participated on that album, and we all worked very hard on making that album a fantastic album that it turned out to be. I even wrote a couple of songs with Brian on that album, but I never said that. But it was, you know, it got a life of its own. So one of the things I was able to address in my story was what I actually did say or do and what I didn't say or do. And so that's good. I was able to give my truth and my experience as one of the Beach Boys. And so I think that's great. You know, I finally got a chance to do that.
You know, we're running out of time. Folks, I just got to tell you, this is the guy who wrote Be True to Your School, California Girls, Kokomo, on and on, did not get credit for it until he actually had to sue to get it in the late 90s. And to hear him describe that, it must have been incredible to live with. So check the book out to get that. But tell us as we go here, Mike, what's life like now at 75? Are you happy with who you are and where you are?
Oh, it's fantastic. The Beach Boys did 172 performances last year, and we're closing in on about 160 this year. Every time we step on stage, we see a whole bunch of people having a great time enjoying our music. We took a family hobby, which was to harmonize and sing together, and it became a profession. So it's been a phenomenal journey.
It has been a wild ride. The book, folks, is called Good Vibrations, the largely untold story of Mike Love, the longest-serving member of the group, and he was there for it all. In this book, he takes no prisoners as he documents the ride that has been the Beach Boys. Mike, thanks so much for your time, and good luck with the book. You know, one of the things we work hard to do every day is to spread the truth that every day we're alive is precious, and that a day at 60 or 80 or 100 is every bit as valuable as a day at 30 or 40. And yet, for some reason, our culture wants to devalue our later years, and we end up thinking that our best days are behind us. But even as we age and our bodies slowly grow weaker, our spirit, our wisdom, our creativity, our curiosity, compassion, and our capacity to learn and to experience love and joy only grow stronger.
Now get this, a day at 80 or 90 can be filled with as much opportunity and possibility as a day at 20 or 30. Start growing bolder, no matter how old you are. See you next time.
The Growing Bolder Radio Show is a production of Growing Bolder, LLC, all rights reserved. This program was recorded at Growing Bolder Studios in Orlando and is available as a weekly podcast on NPR One, iTunes, Spotify, and TuneIn. It is written and produced by Jill Middleton, Mark Middleton, and Bill Schaefer. Technical director is Jason Morrow. Production manager is Michael Nanis. Chief audio engineer is Mac Dula. And our most important team member, you. Follow us on Facebook and Instagram to keep growing bolder every day.
Crimson flames tied through my ears, flowing high and mighty traps. Countless fires.